Each spring, as those of you who have been with us for a number of years now know, I offer as one of the items for our service auction a sermon of one's choice. And each spring, as that piece comes around on that part of the evening, I feel a certain anxiety rising up in me. What if nobody bids on this thing? What kind of a message is that going to be? Of course, then when the bidding starts, my anxiety moves to another area as I see the bids, you know, see people getting competitive things, the bids start going up, and I start thinking, how on earth am I supposed to come up with any kind of a sermon that's going to justify the kind of money these people are bidding on, because I sure know that I wouldn't play that kind of money to hear myself hold forth on anything. Well, last spring we had a first, and two people who were bidding, I guess, against each other, finally decided to just stop and settle on a price, they'd split the difference, and then they would get together on a sermon title for me. That was Steve Ledoux and Jim McCormick. And they asked if I would do one on a sermon about Michael Servetus, who is generally credited with being the founder of Unitarian Universalism in the mid-16th century, or what eventually became Unitarianism. I'm not sure that he ever used that term for himself. He's also regarded as the first Unitarian martyr. I don't know if there was a second Unitarian martyr, so he probably has that all to himself. Not that he wanted it, because he certainly didn't. So I thought, well, how do I tell this man's story in such a way that will be, interesting and also have some kind of contemporary relevance? And as I thought about his remarkable life, it occurred to me that it really wouldn't make a bad movie. Kind of along the lines of A Man for All Seasons, kind of a period movie piece. If you saw that movie, it was, you know, Sir Thomas More is the protagonist and Henry VIII is the antagonist, and it ends with Thomas More being executed. But I think I'd start my Servetus flick off with the execution, and then I would do it in kind of a flashback. So what you're going to witness for the next few minutes here is my very short-lived career as a screenwriter. So here's what would go. You start off with a blank screen, upon which appear the words, October 27, 1553, Geneva, Switzerland. We see the sun coming up over 16th century Geneva, move in for a tight shot of a jail from which bedraggled, chained prisoners being led forth by guards and a clergyman whom the prisoner ignores. They proceed to the center of town where a crowd is gathered around a freshly cut pile of rather green boughs with a stake in the middle. Prisoner is tied to the stake, his books are tied to his waist, he's given one last chance to recant his heresy, which he refuses to do, the fires are lit, the green wood has been deliberately used so it will burn slowly. So it's so slow that I'm told, by one account, it takes a couple of hours to burn the poor man to death. I couldn't use that much screen time to show 2 hours worth of a guy burning to death, but I'd want to show how the time passed that it took. And going by what I know of this incident, I'd have the condemned man, Michael Servetus, at some point cry out, O Jesus, Son of the Eternal God, have mercy upon me. The next scene would show a conversation between the man who was the attending clergyman at this thing, his name was Guillaume Farel, and John Calvin, one of the principal architects of the Protestant Reformation. They'd be having a conversation in which Mr. Farel would say to John Calvin that Servetus could have saved himself the flames if he had simply called out to Jesus as the Eternal Son of God rather than the Son of the Eternal God. For that indeed was Servetus's capital crime. He believed Jesus to be the Son of God, but not God himself, which was what the traditional doctrine of the Trinity held. And his unwillingness to just rearrange his words a little bit was what cost him his life. But there's more to it than that, as we see as we go along. Now we flash back about 30 years to the town of Villanueva, Spain, where Servetus grows up, and we show a 14-year-old Michael Servetus as Miguel Serveto, studying under the tutelage of a Franciscan monk with a possible eye towards the priesthood, and we let the movie then run from there. Now the challenge, if I were trying to put together a film like this, the challenge would be to try to put it somehow in the context of that time, sort of what the cultural mindset was at that time, so that when you finally get to the poor guy being executed, you've seen some kind of progression so that it makes some kind of sense. Now, a perverted kind of a sense nonetheless, but still some kind of a progression there. So here's somehow what I would have to show. I'd have to show that there's no such thing at that point as secular democracies. And the way that most Western nations have been today to greater or lesser extents. Any kind of democracy, secular or otherwise, is still in its very, very fledgling state at this point. Democratic nation states as we know them are still way off. French Revolution isn't going to happen for another 200 years. And of course, there's no such thing as church-state separation, which means that to challenge the official religion of a nation state or any kind of political entity which also has an official religion is to make yourself the enemy of the state. In effect, you're committing treason. Now, in the days of young Servetus, this system is just beginning, only just beginning to break down. It's still very much intact, but it's starting to kind of fray a little bit around the edges. Servetus was either 6 or 8 years old, depending upon the year of his birth, which is in somewhat dispute. He was either 6 or 8 years old when, over in Germany, Martin Luther posted his famous 95 Theses that began the Protestant Reformation. The other major happening at this time, which I somehow have to try to get into my movie here, is the invention of the printing press, which meant that, among other things, any literate person who could get his hands on a Bible could read it for himself. I'm afraid it was himself in those days. And then draw his own conclusions as to what the text said and meant, rather than relying solely upon what the church authorities said and meant. Which is just what Servetus did, which gets us back into our film. He decides to choose the practice of law over the priesthood. He goes to a university in France, Toulouse, and there he reads the Bible. And its contents begin to work its way through his very precocious, and by many accounts, his insufferably argumentative mind. And what strikes him the most as he reads this, and when he gets to the New Testament, is that there's no biblical basis for the Trinity. And this is important to him because back in his native Spain, which is where he grew up, even though Catholicism has now come to reign supreme, there's still a pretty significant Jewish and a pretty significant Muslim population back in his native Spain. And Servetus thinks, you know, person of Jesus, you know, his life, his teachings, that could be pretty attractive to Jews and to Muslims if they didn't also have to believe that the guy was God in order to be a Christian. And he further thinks, he was kind of naive in some ways, he further thinks, well, why don't I just make that happen? I'll go off, I'll join the Protestant Reformation, I'm going to leave Catholicism, I'm going to become a Protestant, and I'm going to debunk the idea of the Trinity, and Protestant Christianity will then become a universal religion because of the universal appeal of the person of Jesus. Makes sense. So he leaves his law studies there, heads off to Switzerland, which has kind of become one of the stronger outposts, if you will, of the Protestant Reformation. And in 1553, he publishes a book called On the Errors of the Trinity. Actually, he wrote it in Latin. That's the anglicized version of it. And much to his surprise, this book gets him in much deeper stuff with the Protestants than it does the Catholics. Remember now, the Protestant Reformation was really more of a protest against certain practices of the Catholic Church than it was about doctrine. The practices of the 16th century Catholic Church, selling of indulgences, the corruption of the papacy, all of that. That's what really got the Protestant, Reformation going. The Protestants needed to show, however, that they were doctrinally pure Christians, and they didn't need somebody like Servetus coming along and challenging one of the central core doctrines of the Christian faith. He was an embarrassment to them, so they just distanced themselves from him. And also, somehow or other, this book finds its way to the Spanish Inquisition in Spain. Some of those folks read it, and they summon Servetus to come and appear before the Inquisition. He was smart enough to not do that. He decides it's time to change his identity and go hide out somewhere. He goes back to Paris. He changes his name. If he had access to a plastic surgeon, he probably would have changed his identity in some way. And he begins a career in medicine. And he becomes Dr. Michael de Villeneuve. And in the course of his medical career, he makes some very significant discoveries about the circulation of the blood, which actually led to some of the advances made in modern medicine. You talk to a medical historian and ask him or her who Michael Servetus is, and they'll tell you he's somebody who, as I just said, made some very important discoveries about the circulation of the blood. And then he got himself killed over some kind of a crazy religious thing. You know, it's kind of where they go with it. Well, one of the mysteries of Servetus's life is why he didn't just stay a doctor. Would have saved himself a lot of grief, to say nothing of his life. And during his French doctor phase, he also became a part of a movement in 15th and 16th century France of people who called themselves humanists. Now, it's not exactly the same kind of humanists that comes up in our mind when we use the term today. They were not anti or not non-religious. These humanists held that a person glorified God by celebrating their intellect and their creative powers. And this led Servetus to also dispute the doctrine of original sin, for which he also found no basis. So he couldn't leave well enough alone with this whole religion thing. And he writes another book called The Restoration of Christianity. And he's writing it to say that if we could embrace Jesus as the Son of God, because he was a human being who best lived out the godliness that is in every one of us. Again, he thought, this idea would catch on. Christianity would be restored. And so he thinks, this is what I'm going to do now. I'm going to restore Christianity. And so again, showing his naivete, he starts a correspondence with John Calvin, who, as I said, is the chief architect now of the Protestant Reformation, and he's based in Geneva, Switzerland. So staying with the movie motif now, if I were doing this a movie, Servetus is the protagonist, Calvin is the antagonist. I'd have to figure out some way to do it so you'd see what was going on in Calvin's life on the one hand and what was going on in Servetus' life on the other, and finally got into Geneva and all that happened there, which would be a good movie, but I don't have time to do that right now. Servetus just figures, well, I'll go to Geneva and I can just convince Calvin by the strength of argument and reason about my brand of Christianity. Servetus believed in the power of ideas above all else. If I can just do that, he'll see the light. And Christianity itself will find harmony with these enlightenment principles and values. So I'll just go to Geneva and work all this out with my little pen pal, John Calvin here. Very, very big mistake. Very huge mistake. Very fatal mistake. So here's my scene in the movie. Is Michael Servetus riding into Geneva with this sort of Don Quixote kind of an air about him, with his books in his saddlebags and this air of confidence about what he's going to confront Calvin with. And you've got Calvin looking out the window as he comes into town. He says, that guy is not going to get out of this town alive. It didn't quite happen that way. I'm taking a little cinematic license. But what reportedly did take place is that when Calvin read some of his correspondence with Servetus about all these theological matters, he, Calvin, said to that aforementioned Dion Farrell, you know, the guy who was at the execution to see if Servetus was going to recant or not, he said to him, if my authority is of any avail, I will not suffer him to get out alive. But that's what the Servetus-Calvin showdown was really about. It was as much about Calvin's political authority as it was anything to do with theology. If my authority, Calvin's words now, if my authority is of any avail, I will not suffer him to get out alive. So Servetus, as it was cooked before he even crossed the city limits. He was arrested, jailed, tried for heresy, and condemned to death in the manner I described earlier. Now here's the part. None of this, technically, was done by Calvin. It was actually accomplished by decisions of the Council of Geneva, a very early experiment in democracy. This was not a king saying off with his head. This was a council in a supposedly democratic state voting to have him put to death in a supposedly enlightened city. And because Calvin commanded the religious allegiance of the overwhelming majority of the citizenry of Geneva, he also represented and embodied the political base of the Council of Geneva. And that's something you can be sure the council did not take lightly. And if Calvin had already sworn that Servetus was not going to leave town alive, then to have him do so would have compromised Calvin's political as well as his religious authority, and he wasn't going to let that happen. So Servetus went to an agonizing death. And Calvin's political base and his political authority in Geneva remained secure. And I'm not sure if Servetus ever figured out that he was dying for political as much as theological reasons. Servetus was a brilliant theologian and physician, but he didn't understand hardball, down and dirty politics, which is what he really ran into. Calvin knew his politics as well as his theology, and he knew how to play in both ballparks. Calvin had made himself the tail, the wagged the dog of civic law in Geneva. So, if I were making a movie of all this, I think Mike and John would be about as good a title as I could figure. And, you know, maybe during coffee hour, if you could figure out who, you know, which actor should play each one. You know, try that one out. Try that out. I would offer it as an historical piece, and I would also offer it as a metaphor for our times. Now, in this country. Now, notice I said metaphor for our times, not a replication of our times, because, of course, we do not now execute people over obscure points of theology. Religious persecution, just for the sole sake of religious persecution, pretty much went the way of the Salem witch trials. But the political dynamics that led up to the execution of Servetus had a certain ring of familiarity to them. At least they do in my ears. For what you had there in Geneva were the political powers that be and the faith base that supported them, each doing what they had to do in order to stay simpatico with one another. And that piece does sound a bit familiar to me. Consider this. It was James Dobson, the head of probably the most powerful religious right organization in our country right now, Focus on the Family. It was James Dobson who was reportedly the first person consulted by the president's chief political advisor when Harriet Myers was nominated for the Supreme Court. Now, in this case, we know the move backfired. We know what happened with that. But I am struck nonetheless by how it was a person who represented a particular religious constituency that got the first call and whose approval was the first one sought when it came to placing a person or attempting to place a person on the highest civil court in our land. We're not burning religious heretics at the stake, but certain echoes of Calvin's Geneva, I would say, are still around. Or consider this. No demonstrable reason has ever been demonstrated to me, anyway, as to how the presence of legally married, same-sex couples in our society pose any threat to the civic and political order or any threat to our societal well-being. I've yet to have that demonstrated or shown. The only reason I can discern, and so why then has this issue become one of the most politically hot-button matters of our time, when it really doesn't have a whole lot of bearing just on how things work out there, or in here, or anywhere else? And the only reason I can discern is because there is a religiously motivated political base that opposes such a move, and that base holds a nice chunk of political capital for any of those who will cater to it. If there's ever a case of a particular religious constituency being the religious tail that wags the civic dog, this is it. Similar kind of thing goes with this whole intelligent design business, but I'll leave that for another time. But I would say that Mr. Calvin is alive and doing rather well in some quarters. Well, finally then, why do we, in this religious community, and with the religious tradition we represent, why do we claim Michael Servetus as our founder? Most of his theology we would find arcane, if not incomprehensible. He had some really weird ideas about the devil and a whole demonology that, again, I don't have time to develop. His Christian humanism still resonates favorably, certainly with me, presumably with a number of you. But he was not, by most accounts, a very pleasant person. He loved to argue. Just for the sake of arguing. Personality-wise, he was not a nice guy. And we sure do love nice So I'm not sure how well you got along with us. He wasn't someone you'd probably want to invite to your circle dinner. Unless you were prepared to debate at length practically any topic that might come up. You know, if it was dark outside, you might want to argue that the sun was shining. I mean, you know, that's, you know people like this. So anyway, his legacy, however, is very important to us for a few reasons. As word of his death and the manner in which it had happened spread, a certain revulsion about it did set in, at least on the part of some of the Protestant reformers, which caused them to repudiate the idea that alleged heretics should be punished by civil magistrates. His death actually began a turn, a very slow and halting turn, but still it began a turn towards tolerance in religious matters in Europe. And even in Geneva, years after his death, the Genevan Calvinists erected what they called an expiatory monument to Servetus. An expiatory monument. To expiate means to make amends, to atone for. It's kind of a way of saying, gee, we're sorry. That's what they did this thing for. That was not because they had come to agree with his views, but because they repudiated the idea of violence, to say nothing of death, being used to enforce Orthodox doctrine. So part of Servetus' legacy was a backlash that led to a more general mood of toleration in matters of religion in Europe, which eventually and slowly, haltingly evolved into the kind of religious freedom that we know today. For us as religious liberals, I see his legacy rooted in that moment when he read the Bible for himself and drew his own conclusions accordingly. Many of his conclusions, as I've already said, are not ones that we would draw. But the process of what happened there is what's important. For what Servetus did was find his religious truth in the interaction between the content of faith, which the Bible represented, and the workings of the human mind. Faith and reason, working together and not as adversaries to give you a faith stance. That's what was going on with him. Taking what others have offered as their revelation of truth, which is what the Bible is, and putting that into dialogue with the workings of your mind and your spirit is what brings forth your own truth. The point is not for us to reach the same conclusions that Servetus did, but it is to trust the workings of our minds and the workings of our human spirit in dialogue with what we sometimes call the wisdom of the ages in coming to those truths that we feel we can live out. This is what Servetus did, and this is why I think he merits being seen as our spiritual ancestor and founder. So the lessons of Servetus' life, lessons of his death rather, is a lesson in what can happen when religious authority, an extreme example, I will say, of what can happen when religious authority becomes the tail that wags the dog of the civic order. The legacy of his death proved to be one of increased toleration in the civic realm when it comes to matters of religion. The legacy of his life is one that celebrates the workings of the human mind and the human spirit in the search for truth, the very thing that we celebrate in this congregation. So I'm going to end on this. John Calvin, for a number of legitimate historical reasons, is considered the founder of Presbyterianism. Now, Calvin's theology bears about as much resemblance to Presbyterian theology today as Servetus' theology bears to ours, but historically speaking, Calvin is the founder of Presbyterianism. So my final plea this morning is, don't go ganging up on your Presbyterian friends and telling them that your guy killed our guy. We've all gotten past that by now. I think about Reverend Tom Woodward over at the Presbyterian Church. He's one of my closest interfaith colleagues. He's a hardworking member of the Granite State Organizing Project, so don't go getting his parishioners all upset. Instead, I only ask that you give thanks for the life of Michael Servetus, you give thanks for what he came to represent, and you carry his spirit forth. Thinking of him, we will sing our closing hymn, which is For All the Saints. And Sandra gave me some instructions on this, which I've already forgotten, so I'm going to let you do it again.
Just be aware that the verses 1, 2, and 4 are on the left-facing page. Verse 3 is on the right page. Please sing it.